This is East End Inc. Each February, Sag Harbor's John Germain Library and Canio's Books invite neighbors to read from their favorite Afro-American writers. Tonight, we hear the work of Lucille Clifton, Claudia Rankine, Bryan Stevenson, Wallace Thurman, Frederick Douglass, and Maya Angelou, all recorded at Canio's Books this month. Nancy Myers of the John Germain Library began the reading with an untitled poem by Lucille Clifton. Ms. Clifton, who died in 2010 in Baltimore, was an American poet, writer, and educator. Clifton was nominated twice for the Pulitzer Prize for poetry.
The light that came to Lucille Clifton came in a shift of knowing, when even her fondest sureties faded away. It was the summer she understood that she had not understood, and was not mistress even of her own off eye. Then the man escaped, throwing away his tie, and the children grew legs and started walking, and she could see the peril of an unexamined life. She closed her eyes, afraid to look for her authenticity. But the light insists on itself in the world. A voice from the non-dead past started talking. She closed her ears, and it spelled out in her hand, "You might as well answer the door, my child. The truth is furiously knocking."
Next, Bill Burford reads from Claudia Rankine's Citizen, an American lyric, and a poem, Memory is a Tough Place. Claudia Rankine is the author of 5 volumes of poetry, 2 plays, and various essays. She was born in 1963.
To live through the days, sometimes you moan like a deer. Sometimes you sigh. The world says, stop that. Another sigh. Another stop that. Moaning elicits laughter. Sighing upsets. Perhaps each sigh is drawn into existence to pull in, pull under. Who knows? Truth be told, you could no more control those sighs than that which brings the sighs about. The sigh is the pathway to breath. It allows breathing. It's just self-preservation. No one fabricates that. You sit down, you sigh, you stand up, you sigh. The sighing is a worrying exhale of an ache. You wouldn't call it an illness. Still, it is not the iteration of a free being. What else to liken yourself to but an animal, the ruminant kind? You like to think memory goes far back, though remembering was never recommended. Forget all that, the world says. The world's had a lot of practice. No one should adhere to the facts that contribute to narrative, the facts that create lives. To your mind, feelings are what create a person, something unwilling, something wild, vandalizing whatever the skull holds. Those sensations form a someone. The headaches begin then. Don't wear sunglasses in the house, the world says, though they soothe. Soothe sight. Soothe you. The head's ache evaporates into a state of numbness, a cave of sighs. Over the years, you lose the melodrama of seeing yourself as a patient. The sighing ceases. The headaches remain. You hold your head in your hands. You sit still. Rarely do you lie down. You ask yourself, how can I help you? A glass of water? Sunglasses? The enteric-coated tablets live in your purse next to your license. The sole action is to turn on tennis matches without the sound. Yes, and though watching tennis isn't a cure for feeling, it is a clean displacement of effort. Will and disappointment. The world is wrong. You can't put the past behind you. It's buried in you. It's turned your flesh into its own cupboard. Not everything remembered is useful, but it all comes from the world to be stored in you. Who did what to whom on which day? Who said that? She said what? What did he just do? Did she really just say that? He said what? What did she do? Did I hear what I think I heard? Did that just come out of my mouth, his mouth, your mouth? Do you remember when you sighed? Memory is a tough place. You were there. If this is not the truth, it is also not a lie. There are benefits to being without nostalgia. Certainly nostalgia and being without nostalgia relieve the past. Sitting here, there are no memories to remember. Just the ball going back and forth, shored up by this external net. The problem is not one of a lack of memories. The problem is simply a lack before, during, and after. The chin and your cheek fit into the palm of your hand. Feeling better?
Next, Margie Pulkingham reads from Brian Stevenson's Just Mercy, a story of justice and redemption. The book looks at the criminal justice system through the eyes of a young lawyer who fought to overturn the conviction of an Alabama man sentenced to die for a murder he didn't commit. Stevenson founded the Equal Justice Initiative to help criminals on death row. In this excerpt, Stevenson described his talk at a church in Alabama.
During the talk, I noticed an older man in a wheelchair who had come in just before the program started. He was in his 70s and he was wearing an old brown suit. His gray hair was cut short with unruly tufts here and there. He looked at me intensely throughout my presentation, but showed no emotion or reaction during most of the talk. His focused stare was unnerving. A young boy who was about 12 had wheeled him into the church, probably his grandson or a relative. I noticed that the man occasionally directed the boy to fetch things for him. He would wordlessly nod his head, and the boy seemed to know that the man wanted a fan or a hymnal. After I finished speaking, the group sang a hymn to end the session. The older man didn't sing, but simply closed his eyes and sat back in his chair. After the program, people came up to me. Most folks were very kind and expressed appreciation for my having taken the time to come and talk to them. Several young black boys walked up to shake my hand. I was pleased that people seemed to value the information I shared. The man in the wheelchair was waiting in the back of the church. He was staring at me. When everyone else had left, he nodded to the young boy, who quickly wheeled him up to me. The man's expression never changed as he approached me. He stopped in front of me, leaned forward in his wheelchair, and said forcefully, "Do you know what you're doing?" He looked very serious, and he wasn't smiling. His question threw me. I couldn't tell what he was really asking or whether he was being hostile. I didn't know what to say. He then wagged his finger at me and asked again, "Do you know what you're doing?" I tried to smile to diffuse the situation, but I was completely baffled. "I think so." He cut me off and said loudly, "I'll tell you what you're doing. You're beating the drum for justice." He had an impassioned look on his face. He said it again, emphatically, "You've got to beat the drum for justice." He leaned back in his chair, and I stopped smiling. Something about what he said had sobered me. I answered him softly, "Yes, sir." He leaned forward again and said hoarsely, "You've got to keep beating the drum for justice." He gestured and after a long while said again, "Beat the drum for justice." He leaned back, and in an instant he seemed tired and out of breath. He looked at me sympathetically and waved me closer. I did so, and he pulled me by the arm and leaned forward. He spoke very quietly, almost a whisper, but with a fierceness that was unforgettable. "You see this scar on the top of my head?" He tilted his head to show me. "I got that scar in Greene County, Alabama, trying to register to vote in 1964. "You see this scar on the side of my head?" He turned his head to the left, and I saw a 4-inch scar just above his right ear. "I got that scar in Mississippi, demanding civil rights." His voice grew stronger. He tightened his grip on my arm and lowered his head some more. "You see that mark?" There was a dark circle at the base of his skull. "I got that bruise in Birmingham after the Children's Crusade." He leaned back and looked at me intensely. "People think these are my scars, cuts, and bruises." For the first time, I noticed that his eyes were wet with tears. He placed his hands on my head. "These aren't my scars, cuts, and bruises. These are my medals of honor." He stared at me for a long moment, wiped his eyes, and nodded to the boy, who wheeled him away. I stood there with a lump in my throat, staring after him. After a moment, I realized that the time to open up the Alabama office had come. The office he's talking about is the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama.
This is East End, Inc. on WPKN Radio. We continue with this program of Afro-American literature recorded this month at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor. Next, Catherine Zocca reads The Blacker the Berry by the Harlem Renaissance writer Wallace Thurman. The 1929 book explores discrimination within the black community based on skin color.
More acutely than ever before, Emmalou began to feel that her luscious black complexion was somewhat of a liability, and that her marked color variation from the other people in her environment was a decided curse. Not that she minded being black. Being a Negro necessitated having a colored skin. But she did mind being too black. She couldn't understand why such should be the case. Couldn't comprehend the cruelty of the natal attenders who had allowed her to be dipped, at it as it were, in indigo ink, when there were so many more pleasing colors on nature's palette. Biologically, it wasn't necessary either. Her mother was quite fair, so was her mother's mother, and her mother's brother, and her mother's brother's son. But then, none of them had had a black man for a father. Why had her mother married a black man? Surely, there had been some eligible brown-skinned men around. She didn't particularly desire to have had a high yaller father, but for her sake, certainly, some more happy medium could have been found. She wasn't the only person who regretted her darkness either. It was an acquired family characteristic, this moaning and grieving over the color of her skin. Everything possible had been done to alleviate the unhappy condition. Every suggested agent had been employed, but her skin, despite bleachings, scourgings, and powderings, had remained black, fast black, as nature had planned and effected. She should have been a boy. Then color of skin wouldn't have mattered so much, for wasn't her mother always saying that a black boy could get along, but that a black girl would never know anything but sorrow and disappointment? But she wasn't a boy. She was a girl, and color did matter. Mattered so much that she would rather have missed receiving her high school diploma than to have to sit as she now sat, the only odd and conspicuous figure on an auditorium platform of the Boise High School. Why had she allowed them to place her in the center of the first row? And why had they insisted upon her dressing entirely in white, so that surrounded as she was by similarly attired pale-faced fellow graduates, she resembled, not at all remotely, that comic picture her Uncle Joe had hung in his bedroom. The picture wherein the black, kinky head of a little red-lipped pickaninny lay like a fly in a pan of milk amid a white expanse of bedclothes. But of course, she couldn't have worn blue or black when the call was for the wearing of white, even if white was not complementary to her complexion. She would have been odd-looking anyway, no matter what she wore, and she would also have been conspicuous. For not only was she the only dark-skinned person on the platform, she was also the only Negro pupil in the entire school, and had been for the past 4 years. Well, thank goodness the principal would soon be through with his monotonous farewell address, and she and the other members of her class would advance to the platform center as their names were called and receive the documents which would signify their unconditional release from public school.
Next, Bill Chaliff reads a text by Frederick Douglass, written about 1835.
New York, 17 years ago, was less a place of safety for a runaway slave than now. And all know how unsafe it now is under the new Fugitive Slave Bill. I was much troubled. I had very little money, enough to buy me a few loaves of bread, but not enough to pay board outside a lumberyard. I saw the wisdom of keeping away from the shipyards, for if Master Hugh pursued me, he would naturally expect to find me looking for work amongst the caulkers. For a time, every door seemed closed against me. A sense of my loneliness and helplessness crept over me and covered me with something bordering on despair. In the midst of thousands of my fellow men, and yet a perfect stranger, in the midst of human brothers, and yet more fearful of them than of hungry wolves. I was without home, without friends, without work, without money, and without any definite knowledge of which way to go or where to look for succor. Some apology can easily be made for the few slaves who have, after making good their escape, turned back to slavery, preferring the actual rule of their masters to the life of loneliness, apprehension, hunger, and anxiety, which meets them on their first arrival in a free state. It is difficult for a free man to enter into the feelings of such fugitives. He cannot see things in the same light with the slave because he does not and cannot look from the same point from which the slave does. "Why do you tremble?" he says to the slave. "You are in a free state." But the difficulty is in realizing that he is in a free state, the slave might reply. A free man cannot understand why the slave master's shadow is bigger to the slave than the might and majesty of a free state. But when he reflects that the slave knows more about the slavery of his master than he does of the might and majesty of the free state, he has the explanation. The slave has been all his life learning the power of his master, being trained to dread his approach, and only a few hours learning the power of the state. The master is to him a stern and flinty reality, but the state is little more than a dream. He has been accustomed to regard every white man as the friend of his master, and every colored man as more or less under the control of his master's friends, the white people. It takes stout nerves to stand up in such circumstances. A man, homeless, shelterless, breadless, friendless, and moneyless, is not in a condition to assume a very proud or joyous tone, and in just this condition was I while wandering about the streets of New York City and lodging at least one night among the barrels on one of its wharves. I was not only free from slavery, but I was free from home as well. The reader will easily see that I had something more than the simple fact of being free to think of in this extremity. I kept my secret as long as I could, and at last was forced to go in search of an honest man, a man sufficiently human, not to betray me into the hands of slave catchers. I was not a bad reader of the human face, nor long in selecting the right man, when once compelled to disclose the facts of my condition to someone. I found my man in the person of one who said his name was Stuart. He was a sailor, warm-hearted and generous, and he listened to my story with a brother's interest. I told him I was running for my freedom and knew not where to go. Money almost gone, was hungry, thought it unsafe to go to the shipyards for work, and needed a friend. Stuart promptly put me in the way of getting out of my trouble. He took me to his house and went in search of the late David Ruggles, who was then secretary of the New York Vigilance Committee and a very active man in all anti-slavery works. Once in the hands of Mr. Ruggles, I was comparatively safe. I was hidden with Mr. Ruggles several days. In the meantime, my intended wife, Anna, came on from Baltimore, to whom I had written informing her of my safe arrival at New York, and in the presence of Ms. Mitchell and Mr. Ruggles, we were married by Reverend James W.C. Pennington. Mr. Ruggles was the first officer on the Underground Railroad with whom I met after reaching the North, and indeed the first of whom I ever heard anything. Learning that I was a caulker by trade, he promptly decided that New Bedford was the proper place to send me. "Many ships," he said, "are there fitted out for the whaling business, and you may there find work at your trade and make a good living." Thus, in one fortnight after my flight from Maryland, I was safe in New Bedford, regularly entered upon the exercise of the rights, responsibilities, and duties of a free man. I may mention a little circumstance which annoyed me on reaching New Bedford. I had not a cent of money and lacked $2 toward paying our fare from Newport, and our baggage, not very costly, was taken by the stage driver and held until I could raise the money to redeem it. This difficulty was soon surmounted. Mr. Nathan Johnson, to whom we had a line from Mr. Ruggles, not only received us kindly and hospitably, but on being informed about our baggage, promptly loaned me $2 with which to redeem my little property. I shall ever be deeply grateful, both to Mr. and Mrs. Nathan Johnson, for the lively interest they were pleased to take in me in this hour of my extremest need. They not only gave myself and my wife bread and shelter, but taught us how to begin to secure those benefits for ourselves. Long may they live, and may blessings attend them in this life and in that which is to come. Once initiated into the new life of freedom, and assured by Mr. Johnson that New Bedford was a safe place, the comparatively unimportant matter as to what should be my name came up for consideration. It was necessary to have a name in my new relations. The name given by my beloved mother was no less pretentious than Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey. I had, however, before leaving Maryland, dispensed with the Augustus Washington and retained the name Frederick Bailey. Between Baltimore and New Bedford, however, I had several different names, the better to avoid being overhauled by the hunters, who I had good reason to believe would be put on my track. Among honest men, an honest man may well be content with one name, and to acknowledge it at all times in all places, but towards fugitives, Americans are not honest. When I arrived at New Bedford, my name was Johnson, and finding that all the Johnson family in New Bedford were already quite numerous, sufficiently so to produce some confusion in attempts to distinguish one from another, there was more reason for making another change in my name. In fact, Johnson had been assumed by nearly every slave who had arrived in New Bedford from Maryland, and this much to the annoyance of the original Johnsons, of whom there were many, in that place. Mine host, unwilling to have another one of his own name added to the community in this unauthorized way, after I spent a night and day at his house, gave me my present name. He had been reading The Lady of the Lake and was pleased to regard me as a suitable person to wear this, one of Scotland's many famous names.
Here is Nancy Myers of the John Germain Library in Sag Harbor reading Maya Angelou's Still I Rise.
You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? 'Cause I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides, just like hope springing high, still I'll rise. Did you want to see me broken, bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries? Does my haughtiness offend you? Don't you take it awful hard, 'cause I laugh like I've got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words, you may cut me with your eyes, you may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past that's rooted in pain, I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak that's wondrously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise, I rise, I rise.
This is East End Inc. We heard a portion of a reading of Afro-American writers recorded at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor this month. The reading, an annual occurrence, was co-sponsored by the John Germain Library. We heard the work of Lucille Clifton, Claudia Rankin, Brian Stevenson, Wallace Thurman, Frederick Douglass, and Maya Angelou. Here are some upcoming literary events produced by Canio's Cultural Cafe at 290 Main Street, Sag Harbor, all at 5 p.m. On Saturday, March the 17th, a St. Patrick's Day concert with Irish history expert and musician-performer Terence Sullivan. On Saturday, April the 21st, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Schultz, introduced by poet Grace Shulman, reads from his new collection, Luxury. East End Inc. is heard on the fourth Wednesday each month. Programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com, where you will find a link to East End Inc. podcasts. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Callendrell and Catherine Soka. This is Hazel Kahn.